Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. On this episode, our guest is Jake Wood, who talks about serving with the U.S. Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan, and about Team Rubicon, the disaster response organization that he co-founded with a fellow Marine in 2010. 70% of the now over 100,000 U.S. volunteers that serve with Team Rubicon are military veterans.
It all started with a mission to Haiti 10 years ago.
Let's get the supplies offloaded fast. Let's do this quickly.
Eight strong, we crossed the Rubicon and never looked back, cementing our commitment to a new mission and a greater purpose. Fueled by those inspired to support our mission and drawing from the ranks of over 20 million military veterans and first responders, our team has grown to over 100,000 volunteers. We have the skills and leadership to meet any challenge. We've hung up our uniforms, but we're still built to serve.
That is a clip from Team Rubicon's 10-year anniversary video, and its co-founder and CEO, Jake Wood, joins us from Los Angeles. Mr. Wood, you have a new book as well called Once a Warrior. What will readers get in that book?
Readers will get a lot. I certainly hope that they'll get some inspiration. The book is really the story of my journey going to war, my journey coming home, and ultimately what's transpired over the last decade. You mentioned the work that I do with Team Rubicon. The book really focuses in the back half on how I found really a new purpose in building that nonprofit organization and responding to disasters in communities all across the globe, and along the way, recruiting tens of thousands of men and women who serve just like me to do that work alongside me.
The mission of Team Rubicon, as we could even see from that short clip, is very hands-on. How has it been impacted the past year by COVID?
I think Team Rubicon is no different than any other organization on the planet. I don't think any of us came into 2020 expecting a global pandemic to grind all of our plans and dreams to a halt, but that's certainly what happened. But I think Team Rubicon really viewed this as an opportunity to demonstrate what we've been doing over the last 10 years. We really felt like we were built for this moment. And so while we didn't have a playbook for COVID-19, we certainly felt like we had the players. And so a lot of things changed for us. You know, our full-time staff, we've got about 200 full-time staff across the country. We've been in a work-from-home posture since March. But that hasn't kept us from getting our teams out into the field. We've been doing everything from continuing our mission responding to natural disasters. We said early that Mother Nature wasn't going to care about COVID-19. And so we immediately began planning to continue to respond to tornadoes and floods and hurricanes in a COVID environment, but also pivoting our operations into assisting communities for this new normal. And that meant everything from deploying nearly 100 medics into Navajo Nation to decompress the medical system there, all the way to deploying nearly 10,000 individuals into food banks across the country to assist them with their operations and logistics to make sure that American families were continuing to get food on their plates. And so we haven't stood idly by. And I think perhaps the most important mission is yet to come. And, you know, that is, as we're rounding the corner on this vaccine, our chief medical officer has been saying, you know, like a drumbeat for the last couple of months, vaccines don't save lives, vaccinations do. And we're about to see one of the largest logistical challenges in the history of the world over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, which is how do we inoculate 350 million Americans and, you know, 6 or 7 billion human beings on this planet, not just once, but twice. And so Team Rubicon is looking and evaluating how we can plug into that as well.
Well, that's sort of an interesting case study in how you operate. So in an example as big as the vaccination rollout, how would a private sector nonprofit like yourself actually get involved in a situation where there's so many public health officials also involved? How do you work?
Yeah, well, everything that we do is in full coordination with federal, state, and local officials. So, you know, we aren't going out there and executing any of these missions, be it COVID-related or disaster-related. In a rogue manner. We are currently conducting extensive outreach across the country into these communities. Many of these communities we have been working in for years, but certainly many of them months. And we responded to over 300 communities in 2020 alone, most of that COVID related. So we have deep ties into these communities. You know, the one thing that we realize is that the real heroes in this work are the doctors, the nurses, the paramedics, who are ultimately going to be sticking needles in arms. They've been, you know, on the front lines of this in the emergency rooms and the ICUs from the beginning of this outbreak. And for many of the local governments, it's up to them to determine how this vaccination is ultimately put into arms, right? So some counties are going to dictate, some public health officials are going to dictate it's got to be a doctor. Some are going to say it's got to be a nurse. Some are going to say, you know what, it can be an EMT, which would probably be the lowest level that we're going to see someone allow to actually conduct the vaccination. So how does that answer your question? We have our own medical teams inside Team Rubicon, but it's a fairly limited capacity. Plus, they're all American physicians, nurses, and EMTs. And so we don't want to rob Peter to pay Paul. We don't want to take, you know, necessary medical providers from one part of the country who are going to be needed to deploy them elsewhere. But what we know is that the real, you know, secret to what we do so well is in our operational planning and in our ability to execute logistics. And so what we want to make sure that happens, as you know, there is going to be such limited capacity and bandwidth across the country, is that the medical professionals do what they do best: treat patients in ICUs, inoculate citizens with the vaccine. They shouldn't be worried about the logistics. They shouldn't be worried about that operational planning. We can take those things off their plate and make sure that we are most effectively and efficiently using their skill set in what is going to be, as I said, a 6 to 12 month effort. So we're really looking to see how we can do that. There are going to be some circumstances where we will actually be doing the inoculations ourselves, or at least we're offering that to some municipalities. We're running three pilot programs right now three locations across the country that are piloting what we can do for vaccinations. And we look to expand that in January, February, as the vaccine becomes more widely available, so that we can really have an impact nationwide.
Well, I'm going to turn back to your life story, which tells the world how Team Rubicon, this organization, got started. And I want to really start at the very beginning, because you take readers on your life journey. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I kind of bounced around a little bit growing up. I was born in Nebraska, and I lived in Texas for a stint. And then when I was a young boy, around 6 or 7 years old, my family moved to Europe. My dad was in manufacturing, and he had a job in Austria in 1989. So I spent two formative years in Austria, going to a German-speaking school, traveling around, had a formative moment that I speak about in the book, where my parents take my sisters and I to a former Nazi concentration camp that was a really powerful experience for me. But then when we moved home, I grew up in the Midwest. I consider Iowa my home. It's where my family still lives. And it was my stepping stone from Iowa that got me to the University of Wisconsin, where I went to school.
I want to go back to that formative experience in Austria, visiting the German concentration camp. You write about how that left a lifelong impression on you. You're a dad now. Has the when you reflect upon how much that one childhood experience stayed with you and helped form the kind of person you are, does it have you think about the kinds of things you'd like to expose your own children to as they grow up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That moment was powerful for me as a young boy. I think it would be for any young boy or girl. The way I often phrase it when I'm speaking to people is that it really taught me the true depths to which humans can sink. It taught me what true evil looks like in society. Certainly the Nazi regime, I think, is unparalleled in its wickedness. For a young 6 or 7 year old boy, prior to that moment, you know, evil was Wile E. Coyote cartoons. And so this was really eye opening. And, you know, I look at today, I look at our own society, I look in our own communities, and I see, you know, these neo-Nazis marching through our streets. And I think to myself, how does somebody grow up and aspire to that same level of horror? It honestly sickens me. And frankly, it hits close to home. I live in Southern California now. I don't think it's an area of the country that most people would think is a hotbed for, you know, neo-Nazis. But I was driving just last week to go pick up a pizza for my family, and I pulled up to a stoplight, and a motorcycle in front of me, the individual had a swastika on the fender of his motorcycle. And it almost brought me to tears in the middle of this intersection looking at it, because I couldn't believe that that's what I was looking at in my own country. So when I think about, when I think about the type of upbringing I want for my little girls, I think that I want to give them a perspective of the world at an early age that allows them to have compassion and empathy for people that that are unlike them, for people that don't have the same privilege that they will have. And I think that's the one thing that's missing in our country today is that perspective. And if you can't have perspective, you can't possibly have empathy.
You mentioned going to college, and when you went there, your eyes were on a pro football career. In the end, you surprised everyone by enlisting. Take me on that journey. What inspired that big change in direction?
Well, I wouldn't say I surprised anybody by not going to play pro football, because it turns out I wasn't that good of a football player. But yeah, I went to the University of Wisconsin on an athletic scholarship to play football, and I played offensive line. And for anybody that follows college football, they'll know that the University of Wisconsin is the top program in the country for sending offensive linemen to the NFL. And so I certainly thought that that was going to be, you know, in the cards for me. And, it turns out it wasn't for a lot of reasons. I wasn't as good as I needed to be to go play pro. But, you know, those were really powerful 4 years for me. They started in 2001. I graduated in 2005. And so anybody that, you know, was a young adult or an adult at that time knows that, you know, in that time period, we were attacked on 9/11. Shortly thereafter, we invaded Afghanistan at the end of 2001. And then about a year and a half later, we were invading Iraq in 2003. And, you know, Madison, Wisconsin is a very liberal campus. It's an incredibly liberal campus. And there was this fierce debate, fierce protests throughout those 4 years about American intervention and involvement in those wars. And you know, I looked at those, I think, with a little bit of naivete. I was fiercely devoted to my country. I remain fiercely devoted to my country, but I think I was unwilling to question the merits of certainly the Iraq war. I was a staunch supporter of it. And, you know, over the course of those 4 years, while I continued to play football, I watched and was, you know, really, I guess, transfixed with, you know, what was happening overseas. Part of me had always wanted to join the military. But, you know, as we already discussed, that lure of going and playing football was just too great. And so as I was sitting there playing football and watching all of this unfold on campus, I continued to feel, you know, this pull to maybe join, but again, was really good at making excuses for why I wouldn't. And then right before my senior year, Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan. And that, I think, was the galvanizing moment for me. I looked at Pat, a former professional football player who walked away at the apex of his career to join the Army after 9/11. And I thought, you know, that's the type of person that I want to be, a person who has that level of conviction to make the necessary and hard choice, regardless of personal cost. And so as soon as I played my final game at Wisconsin, I began preparing to join the military, and I enlisted in the Marine Corps shortly thereafter.
So of all the service branches, why Marines?
You know, I had always been drawn to the Marine Corps. I think that, you know, the Marine Corps has this mystique about it that really spoke to me. When I thought about joining the military, I never thought about joining the Supply Corps or, you know, the Transportation Corps. It was always the infantry. And so there were really only two options. It was going to be the Army or the Marine Corps. And, you know, what I liked about the Marine Corps was just how it positioned itself as, you know, as a challenge. And, you know, it's the way that they recruited people was, you know, you got to earn it. You know, you don't choose to become a Marine. You apply to become a Marine. And if you have what it takes, you might even become one. You know, at that time, the Army was really focused a lot on talking about college benefits and, you know, job training. And I just thought to myself, no, I want to join that legendary Corps. And so it became a pretty easy decision for me, and one I certainly have not regretted.
What years did you serve?
So I served from 2005 to 2009.
And where were you deployed during that time?
In 2007, you know, viewers may recall there was a shift in strategy called the surge in Iraq. President Bush and the Congress authorized a surge of, I think, close to 100,000 additional troops into Iraq. So I was part of the surge in 07. I was sent to Iraq's Anbar province for almost, you know, a little over 7 months. And then a year later, I was sent to Afghanistan's Helmand Valley in 2008.
And what was the trajectory of the war during the two wars during the time period that you were there in country?
I think, in 2007, we got there. In 2007 was the bloodiest year of the Iraq war. More insurgents, both Sunni insurgents and Al-Qaeda in Iraq were killed during that year than any other year. And more U.S. and coalition troops were lost that year than any other year. Nonetheless, there was actually remarkable progress over the course of the 7 months that we were there. I was there during a moment in time that was known as the Sunni Awakening. It was a moment when we first got there, we were fighting a three-way war. We were fighting both the Sunni insurgency and we were fighting AQI, or Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they, of course, were fighting one another. And probably about three quarters of the way through my tour, we finally convinced the Sunnis to agree to a truce with us and turn both of our attention to Al-Qaeda. And the progress was rapid and it was remarkable. And so there was actually pretty remarkable and long-lasting progress while I was there. Now, by long-lasting, that's measured in years, not decades. And we've seen all of that, you know, unravel by the time that ISIS swept through in 2014, 7 years later. In Afghanistan, I think that this was the beginning of the end for Afghanistan. That conflict had been ignored. And the Taliban was gaining strength. They had gone dormant for a number of years. And I think we're starting to see, reap the rotten fruit of that mistake today as we're looking to withdraw. And the Taliban is, probably got a better than 50-50 chance of reclaiming that country. 2008, when we were in Helmand Valley in Afghanistan, my unit lost more Marines than any Marine Corps battalion across both theaters of the war. It was a brutal and bloody tour. And unfortunately, it continued that way for, all the way through, I think, probably 2012.
At what point, if at all, along the way of your service, did you begin to question the whole reason for being there?
I don't think while I was serving, I allowed myself to ask those questions. I think that would have opened up, too much of a chink in my mental and psychological armor. So I didn't really afford myself the latitude to think critically about what we were doing. My sniper partner, Clay Hunt, who was wounded on our first tour in Iraq, he did. And I talk about this in the book. He began questioning the merits of our effort in Afghanistan fairly early in that deployment, actually. And I was cautioning him against allowing himself to do that because, I saw it not questioning it as key to our survival. And that didn't really sit well with him. I think one of the benefits of having written this book over the last year and a half was it really forced me to reflect on my feelings about the wars. And it was fascinating because, over the course of writing this manuscript, 6 or 9 months, even through that forced reflection, my attitudes would change. And at times, I would be, heartbroken over what we did and what we failed to accomplish. And at other times I'd be indignant that people didn't appreciate it more. But I think ultimately I look back on it and, I think that our time in Afghanistan began for the right reasons and under the right auspices and circumstances. And it's just slowly eroded into a bit of an objectiveless mission with really no exit strategy. And that was even by the time that I was there in 2008, and now fast forward another 12 years, I'm not quite sure we fully understand the objectives of our continued involvement. In Iraq, I can look back with clear eyes and say that it was a mistake to invade Iraq. I don't know whether the majority of my fellow veterans can say that as clear-eyed as I can. That doesn't, in my opinion, make our service any less meaningful or noble. I think as a country, we should be able to objectively, look back on these consequential decisions and really take stock of whether they were right or whether they were wrong. I think that makes us stronger as a nation and not weaker. And I wish more of our public officials would do the same.
Clay Hunt, whom you just mentioned, your sniper partner, is an important part of your story. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Clay was a Texas kid that I met in my first infantry platoon in the Marine Corps. He was about my same age. You know, I was pretty old for being in, having just enlisted. And he had taken kind of a wandering route to the Marine Corps himself after high school, going to a couple of colleges, bouncing in and out of them, working at a youth camp, spending some time on some ski slopes as a ski bum. And so we just had, I wouldn't say maybe necessarily a lot in common, but we had a similar maturity. And so we just quickly, clung on to one another and, very close friends very quickly. He was wounded early in our tour in Iraq, and that was very hard for both of us, for me to see my friend get sent home, to see him wounded. And then for him to be home knowing that I was continuing, daily missions and patrols in the deadliest province during the deadliest year of the war was just nerve wracking for him. We both ended up joining the sniper platoon at around the same time. And we were sent to sniper school together and assigned to be partners, which is really a significant thing in sniper school. You spend those entire 10 weeks effectively tethered to one another, never allowed to be more than arm's length away from your partner at any moment. And so you can imagine, being tethered to somebody 3 feet for 10 weeks, you get to know that person really, really well. And what it's trying to drive home is that you are nothing without your partner. You don't survive without your partner. And we deployed to Afghanistan together. And as I mentioned earlier, that's when Clay really began questioning the merits of our involvement there. And when we came back, Clay was one of the first people that I called as Team Rubicon was forming up to go to Haiti. And he ended up joining us down there on the ground in Port-au-Prince. But about a year after Haiti, Clay took his own life in Houston, where he'd moved back to and where he'd been struggling to just really, I think, figure out who he was and who he was going to be. And he fell victim to, this scourge that is plaguing the veteran population, which is the suicide epidemic. And he became one of those statistics, which... as you can imagine, was tragic.
I want to unpack that. There's a lot there in the story you just told, but let's start with your decision to leave the military after 4 years. Was that an easy decision for you to make by that point?
Yes and no. Yes, because my body was really starting to break down. I at the end of my 4-year enlistment, I really had... If I was going to stay in, I was going to have to, from how I was thinking about it, the only way I was going to stay in is if I moved into a special operations community, which was really just getting its feet under itself in the Marine Corps. But of course, that's a physically grueling, mentally and emotionally demanding role. And while I thought I had what it took, I had a bunch of orthopedic injuries from playing football that were just really starting to hurt. And I ultimately ended up having surgery with about 3 or 4 months left in the Marine Corps on my foot to repair a bunch of damage. And so I say, yes, it was an easy decision because while part of me really wanted to stay in, I'm not sure my body could have handled it. But then it wasn't an easy decision. And I think this is really what you'd prefer to talk about. I really struggled with this idea of getting out. I lost some really good friends on those battlefields overseas. And even though at this point there was some doubt that was beginning to creep into my mind, now that I was back home from the tours and I could afford the time and space to reflect on the merits of the missions, even though I was beginning to have doubt about their merits, the idea of giving up on them, the idea of walking away when so many of my friends had died for them, knowing that so many of my friends were going to stay in and continue to fight that mission, it just gnawed at me. And I also think part of it was really just self-destructive behavior. I think I carried a lot of guilt. And it was part of that guilt was simply knowing that I was coming home and I hadn't been wounded. I mean, I served these really bloody tours. People around me were just getting horrifically wounded left and right. And I managed to come home with all my fingers and all my toes completely unscathed. And part of me, if I really am reflecting on it, felt like I needed to continue to deploy until I at least came home with something missing so that I'd never had any doubt about whether or not I did enough. And that's just a really, of course, that's a very foolish way of thinking about, what you owe and the value of your own service. I met a girl, and it's kind of the classic military moment. And, I have subsequently married her, and she's the mother of my two children, but met her after Afghanistan. And she made it very clear that she was not going to be a military spouse. And she was also very blunt in helping me to assess the quality of my arguments for why I should stay in. And so she really helped me think more clearly about what I still owed, or more specifically, that I really didn't owe anything anymore. And that ultimately helped to frame my decision to get out.
Before we leave the 4 years of your military service, readers of your book, Once a Warrior, will have, through your eyes, access to lots of battle scenes. And I'm wondering, did you take notes along the way, or was your recall of all this so sharp in your mind?
Yeah, actually, a lot of the wartime experiences, or wartime stories, rather, I wrote those stories contemporaneously. I wrote a lot and journaled a lot while I was overseas. And so, those moments are fairly true to form. And I was very sensitive to that too. Just because of the word count that I was afforded in publishing this book, there were, some of these scenes that I had to condense so dramatically and leave out moments, that it made me nervous because, I felt like these were important details but ultimately the reader didn't need to know them in order to understand what was going on. But I felt like it was almost a disservice to the other Marines that had experienced those moments. But being so sensitive to how I was representing them, because they're sacred to us who experienced them, these moments of combat, these moments of loss, I floated the book to Marines who were there and said, hey, here's how I remember these moments. Is this how you remember them? And I felt good because I really didn't have anybody come back with anything that was, out of place or that they contested as not how it took place. If anything, they just simply said, yeah, but you forgot about this moment within it. And really I hadn't, it just was on the cutting room floor. Sure. In the editing process.
So the next formative period, as you referenced, was the earthquake in Haiti. Tell me the story of how you ended up going there.
Yeah, well, so I got out of the Marine Corps in late 2009. And by that time, I knew that it was time to leave the Marines, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. And so I thought that I'd probably go back to college to get a graduate degree and really started to zero in on getting my MBA. And so in late 2009, got out, began studying for the GMAT test, took it, and applied to some of the top 10 business schools in the country. I had big aspirations. I wanted to go to a really good school if I was going to take that time and make that investment in myself. And as I was sitting around in January 2010, probably 60 days after getting out of the Marines, I was waiting for those applications to come back. And I turned on the TV one day and the Haiti earthquake was unfolding. And, it was kind of, I often say it was like a 9/11 moment for me. There was so much horror and destruction and suffering. And unlike that moment in 9/11 when I was a freshman in college, I didn't want to be flat-footed. I had made a lot of excuses for why I wouldn't do anything after 9/11, why I wouldn't join the military, why I would let somebody else go and handle that situation. And I kind of refused in that moment, watching the Haiti earthquake unfold, to let that happen again. And so after a couple hours of watching it happen, I turned to my girlfriend, now my wife, and I said, I think I should go down there and help. And, you know, I mentioned how blunt and direct she is. And I really thought she was going to tell me how bad of an idea that was. And to my surprise, she said, yeah, I think that would be, you know, incredible if you could do that. Just do me a favor, find some guys that you can trust to go with. And so I started furiously calling people that I'd served with, trying to cobble together a team to go down to Haiti. Make a long story short, we ended up getting a group of 8 people together, and we rallied in the Dominican Republic, which shares a border with Haiti. And we made it to the border crossing, and we crossed into Haiti about 4 days after the earthquake and made our way into Port-au-Prince. And for the next 3 weeks, we conducted medical triage clinics throughout the city. And for at least those first couple of days, these encampments that we were going to were just full of critically wounded people. I mean, just some of the most horrific wounds I've ever seen. And I say that having seen, wounds on the battlefield. And it was down there that we really discovered that perhaps we had stumbled onto an idea that had, real merit, which ultimately would become Team Rubicon.
Yeah, it seems as though it really happened organically, a combination of 3 realities that hit you: the millions of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who were all volunteers, the number of them that were struggling with post-war realities, and how many disasters there were that needed assistance. But it also seems like a story of social media, because in reading your story, people jumped to the cause because of your posting about it. So It seems like it all happened at the right time. Social media was beginning to develop. There was a need, and there were people to fill it. How did it go from that Haiti experience to saying, we really can build this into an organization that has some legs, some longevity?
Yeah, well, you're right. It wouldn't have happened without social media. And I think as much as some of us would love to put the social media genie back in the bottle these days, it certainly was the fuel that helped Team Rubicon grow into what it is today. I think while we were down in Haiti, we began to believe that we were onto something. You know, historically speaking, the humanitarian community is not big fans of the military, and for good reason. The majority of the humanitarian suffering around the world is the result of armed conflict. And so it's almost as though, career humanitarians despise the military almost out of an obligation. And so we knew that we had been, trained with all of these skills, and we developed all of these experiences overseas in the military that were directly applicable to these disaster zones. And we quickly discerned that none of these humanitarian agencies were recruiting those men and women into their ranks, at least not at large scale. And we just thought that was a really, really just a waste of incredible human capital, because and I explore this a lot in the book, just because we were soldiers or Marines, just because we fought on battlefields, it doesn't mean that we were heartless. It doesn't mean that we lack compassion or empathy, or that we were there for the wrong reasons. It's something that I explore a lot in the text. And so this seed was planted early, and we came back, and I think we were hesitant to commit ourselves to building Team Rubicon. We kind of saw it as, oh, this is a nice idea. We're going to treat it like a hobby. We're going to have a roster of people, maybe a few hundred, that we'll be able to call upon when major disasters like the Haiti earthquake happen. And there'll be no overhead. There'll be no full-time staff. And I think that we were incredibly naive about what it takes to execute these missions. I think if we look back on what we did in Haiti, objectively, we should feel incredibly lucky that none of us died, that we didn't create some catastrophe within the catastrophe. I think we were very naive coming back from Haiti, and I'm not afraid to admit that now. But it was almost this foolishness that allowed us to explore this idea of Team Rubicon. But it really wasn't until Clay died in 2011 that we decided to commit to it full time. You know, it was a year after Haiti. Again, we were kind of treating it like a hobby. I was in grad school, you know, trying to get my MBA. My co-founder was working on, you know, trying to launch another business. But it was in the aftermath of Clay's death that we really just assessed the opportunity that Team Rubicon presented and really served as kind of a reset button in our lives. And at least for me, it was a moment where I said, okay, I think this is what I want to do. And, you know, fast forward a decade later, I'm still doing it.
We've talked so much about Clay. I want to show our viewers a little bit of him from a piece done about him by 60 Minutes. It's just brief. Let's show it.
At 27, he thought he could make the world a better place.
Tell me who you are.
My name is Clay Hunt. I'm here because I'm needed here.
When a massive earthquake struck Haiti in January 2010, Hunt, a Marine combat veteran, went back into action as a humanitarian.
I was there to do a job, to help people, and that was such a great feeling, being able to actually get to work and help people and do good things and not have to worry about getting shot at.
What Clay Hunt didn't say in this video is that by helping others, he was hoping to heal himself from the traumas of war.
I'm sure it is still difficult to hear his voice, even these years later. How did that experience of knowing him and seeing his path that ultimately led to suicide have you also get involved in policy for veterans to the point where legislation was passed in his name?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to overstate my involvement in the passing of the Clay Hunt Save Act. You know, all the credit really for getting that legislation across the finish line is due to groups like Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, in a couple of the big six organizations like the VFW and the American Legion, who really work on advocating and lobbying Congress, you know, for veterans issues full time. I mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, or IAVA. Clay was involved with them early. In fact, shortly after coming back from Haiti, he dragged me to Washington, D.C. for an annual event that they host every year called Storm the Hill. And together, he and I, alongside probably about 30 other veterans, walked through the halls of Congress lobbying legislators for change to for disability reform. And so that group and their founder and CEO at the time, a guy named Paul Rykoff, were really the main thrust in passing a bill through Congress that focused on helping to reform the VA to address the suicide problem head on. And it was one of the most amazing things for me to see that as this bill was working its way through, that they affixed Clay's name to it as the Clay Hunt Save Act. My involvement in it was relatively minimal, but also a very powerful moment for me. After it had been passed and right as President Obama was going to sign it in the East Room, the White House reached out to me as Clay's best friend and asked me to introduce the president for the signing.
Amid his challenges, Clay believed it was the job of the VA to care for him and for others. And he lobbied with IAVA nearly 5 years ago to the day in this very town to ensure the VA had what it needed to achieve their mission. And that's why it is so fitting that we honor his memory here today with this bill. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you very much.
That was a powerful moment. You never know what's going to come out of tragedy. And certainly when Clay died, I had no idea. For me, it was the worst, probably the worst moment of my life. because I felt like I'd let him down, and I felt like it was such a waste of an incredible human being's life that has so much talent, so much potential. But we've managed to make the most of that tragedy, both by committing to Team Rubicon and building it into something that I know he'd be proud of, but also, you know, in passing that legislation and helping to ensure that the VA never let, you know, another veteran down. Now that process is ongoing. The VA has by no means cracked the code on that, but it was a major move forward for them.
We have about 20 minutes left in our conversation. If Clay Hunt's death helped gel and propel the Team Rubicon idea, after that, what were the really formative experiences that you and your early team had that led you to the direction that it is today?
Well, I think the biggest, well, one of the biggest things, though I'm not sure we knew it at the time, was prior to Clay's death, the organization really saw itself as focused exclusively on the international community. We thought of ourselves as a elite, medically focused humanitarian organization that would really only be deploying to developing parts of the world in the aftermath of disasters or crises like civil war. And about a month after, less than a month, probably 3 weeks after Clay's death or after his funeral, a terrible tornado tore through Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And we had no idea what we would do in a domestic context, but we got on a call, my leadership team and I, and we decided that, you know, let's just go. Let's go to Tuscaloosa, send 30 people down there, and let's see what kind of good that we can do. And it was kind of a, we got to just figure it out moment. And honestly, I don't know that we would have gone if Clay had not just been buried. I think that there was this angst inside of us. I think that there was this, just this kind of this growing sense that we had to do something that kind of forced our hand to launch our first domestic mission. And, you know, in Tuscaloosa, you know, we didn't save the world. We helped some families out. We did some good work. But it really dawned on me in the aftermath of that Tuscaloosa mission that our key to success, our key to scale for Team Rubicon was not going to be trying to cobble together 6 or 7 person teams going into remote parts of the world. It was going to be making all of America more resilient to these rising, you know, frequency of disasters by recruiting not hundreds of veterans into it, but hundreds of thousands. And so we really pivoted the entire organization's focus in the aftermath of that, really looking to build our capacity as an elite disaster response organization focused domestically. And that's what we've done. And the next moment of consequence for us was about a year and a half later when Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy made landfall in the Northeast. You know, we'd been kind of limping along since Tuscaloosa, really still struggling to convince donors and funders and partners that we were worth investing in. And we were actually near, you know, approaching financial insolvency when Sandy hit. But we made some bold bets. We ultimately bet on ourselves and believed in ourselves. And we launched, you know, a really large mission, took a lot of risks financially to get almost 500 volunteers on the ground in Brooklyn. And it ended up probably being the most consequential decision that we made, because it really launched us on a completely different trajectory in the coming years, quintupled the size of the organization in a matter of weeks, and really put us on the national stage alongside, you know, really great organizations like, you know, the Red Cross or the Salvation Army, who do such great work in disaster zones.
How is all this funded?
The organization is entirely funded privately. Corporations, foundations, and individuals. We don't take, at least at this point in time, government funding or multinational funding. And so we really rely on the generosity and philanthropy of, you know, private America to fuel our work. And over the course of the last decade, we've raised about $250 million to do it. So it demonstrates just how charitable this country can be.
And how many volunteers do you currently have under the Team Rubicon banner?
We've had about 135,000 volunteers register with the organization over the last decade.
And what's it like to be a TR volunteer? These people all have jobs, I'm sure, that they're leaving for time. So how does that part of it work for them?
Yeah, we kind of, you know, we use the analogy of a volunteer fire department. You know, we are building up a large reservoir of people who are organized and trained. And when called upon, they either answer the call or they can't, you know. So most of them are employed. Some of them are retired. Some of them, of course, are unemployed or they're students. But the vast majority are employed. And so that means that they can't always say yes when we ask them to deploy to a community. But if we ask enough people, we're going to get enough that say, yes, I can go. I can arrange time off from my work. I can arrange childcare. I can get my spouse on board with being gone for 1 week or 2 weeks. And they deploy out. You know, I think the big thing that differentiates Team Rubicon is our commitment to training and to, you know, excellence in the standards that we set. You know, we see training as critical, not just as a method of risk reduction, ensuring that our people know what to do, how to do it safely, but it also helps us to more frequently engage our volunteers. And that frequency of engagement really builds this affinity for not just one another, but for the organization. And so, you know, Team Rubicon almost becomes a part of that person's identity in their life in a way that makes them really, really engaged and committed volunteers. And so it's easier to get them to say yes after they've been to, you know, 5 weekends of training over the course of a couple of years, because they know what they're getting into.
Do you also, because so many of these people are recent veterans of the wars, and you talked about some of the mental health issues of returning, do you also help them with that aspect, or does that happen organically by being part of this larger sense of mission?
Well, I think we always try to be clear that we are not a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I think that I believe PTSD is real. I know it's real. I've seen it. I've seen its impacts in people's lives. For people who have, you know, PTSD that's debilitating, they need clinical help. They need real clinical interventions, whatever that might be. We're really about how do we restore purpose in people's lives. Now, that can be helpful in someone's battle with post-traumatic stress disorder, but it may not be the cure. But we know that by providing people with purpose, by providing people with a sense of community and a newfound identity, we can help them to aspire to become and become the better versions of themselves. We're also big believers in this concept of post-traumatic growth. I truly believe that most military veterans are coming back from these wars in the Middle East stronger and more capable than when they left. They have been invested in their skill. They've been invested in their leadership capacity. They have served a mission that's bigger than themselves. Some of them have experienced trauma. You know, certainly if you were serving in a combat role overseas, there's a good chance that you've experienced traumatic events. But, you know, not everybody responds to that trauma in a way that becomes debilitating through something like PTSD. Often that trauma can help us to become stronger, more resilient, and more capable. And so we really try to convince veterans of that narrative, because I think that's really what we're facing right now as a country, is a battle for the narrative for this generation of veterans. If we tell them that they're broken, they're going to see themselves as broken. They're going to act like they're broken. If we tell them they're stronger, if we tell them that they can be assets in their communities, they're going to rise up to that challenge, and they're going to be exactly that. So we want to be advocates of that more powerful and empowering narrative, rather than one that's perpetuating the, you know, broken man or woman with a haunted past narrative that has often gripped the dialogue in our country.
I wanted to also ask you about leadership, because you write about it in the book. You also speak to groups about leadership skills. Your book is titled Once a Warrior, but in the text you write, you realize that you will always be a warrior. How did your leadership skills develop, and what does that innate sense of being a warrior do to your vision of leadership?
Yeah, well, first of all, my leadership has changed dramatically since I was in the Marine Corps. And that's not to say that my leadership in the Marine Corps was bad or the wrong style. I think that, you know, any leader should aspire to be on a lifelong journey of continuing to evolve as a leader. But, you know, leading Marines in combat and leading employees in an organization or a company, they are radically different. There are some fundamental things that remain the same. You know, you have to have integrity. You have to be loyal. You have to convince the people that you're leading that you care for them, that you love them, that you want to be a part of their aspirations and their future. But, you know, certainly there are many places in which that leadership diverges. You know, this concept of always being a warrior, I've always been drawn to a parable by a Greek philosopher named Heraclitus about the, you know, the 100 men that go into battle. And it finishes by saying that, you know, these 100 men, one is a warrior and it's his or her job to bring all the others home. And I've always found that to be so powerful, this concept that the greatest warrior among 100 that go into combat isn't the greatest because of their prowess, you know, on the battlefield or their physical might or their skill in combat. It's simply because of their responsibility to bring the others home. And so that's always been something that I've latched onto, that true leadership is about being that type of person that others look to help lead them through those moments of chaos, those moments of uncertainty. And I've always aspired to be that type of person for the people that surround me, the type of person that others know that I'll do anything for, regardless of personal cost, regardless of, you know, what the, you know, the consequence is. And I think that that's been imbued within Team Rubicon. I think we have an organization where we so fiercely serve one another and not ourselves that we've just created this unbelievable culture that is really the secret to the success that we've had.
If there are any stress points on that culture as this organization has gotten so large over the years, where would they be?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, there's... scaling as fast as we have over the years, there's always going to be stresses in an organization, fissures that appear. You know, for us, at least culturally, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job of scaling our culture. We posed the question early as we were beginning to grow rapidly. It was a hypothetical. Was culture going to be the victim of our scale, or was it going to be the driver of it? And we posed it that way because a lot of people began questioning back in 2012, 2013, if this special and unique culture that we developed was going to be the victim of our growth. And I just thought that was the wrong way of framing it. And so I always challenged people over the last decade to instead fiercely protect our culture and make it not the victim of scale, but the reason for scale. And, you know, I think that we've done a good job of that. But like any, you know, leader of a large organization, I think that the most constant refrain that we get about what we could do better is communication. It's a challenge that I don't know that any company or leader at scale has been able to crack. Nobody feels like they have the information that they need, you know, or the information that they want. Whereas, you know, leaders always lament that the people aren't listening or reading the information that they're given. So how do you meet those two things in the middle? You know, but I think what we've done well is that consistently in our surveys, in our conversations with our team, related to communication, our team knows that we will always be transparent. We will never sugarcoat a situation with our staff. We will always let them know what we're doing, why we're doing it. We'll let them know the reality of the moments that we're facing, the potential consequences and outcomes, that we'll trust them with that information and treat them like adults in having it. And I think that's really served us well.
Jake, we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to use that 5 minutes to talk about veterans and their service to the country. You wrote in the book, when you leave war, war doesn't let you walk away. It stalks you. There are two versions of me, before the war and after the war. I guess anyone who has a veteran in their life has had some experience of the difficulty of getting them to talk about their war experience. What would your advice be to both veterans and civilians about bridging that gap in communication?
Yeah, I think that as a society, as a republic that has the benefit of an all-volunteer force, we have an obligation as a society to ask those volunteers, those men and women who raise their hands to go and serve our country in foreign lands, to ask them about their experiences. You know, the one thing that I think gets missed in all the conversation about PTSD, which we discussed earlier, is where PTSD begins and ends and where moral injury begins and ends. Moral injury is what happens when you are forced to do something that violates some moral or societal norm, a deeply held belief from that you've had within your life. And this happens often in war. Killing another human being is unnatural. It violates just about every human norm that we have, every moral norm that we have. And yet we have to do that. And that creates a moral injury. That doesn't necessarily create post-traumatic stress. So going back to my comment about society, we can best help that moral injury by bearing it as a society together, by ensuring that no one individual feels like they have to bear the guilt and the shame and the anguish of that moral injury by themselves. And what I've often found is that members of our society don't ask veterans to share those stories for one of two reasons. One, they just incorrectly assume that that veteran will never want to share that story. They'll think that, oh, that person's not going to want to share it with me because it's deeply personal, because I myself haven't served. And so they hesitate to ask. And yes, some veterans will hesitate to share those moments, share those stories. But I think most of them are actually eager to share them, not because they're proud of them, but because they're eager to get that weight off their chest. The second reason that I think members of our society don't ask those questions is because they're afraid that those stories are going to make them uncomfortable. But you know what? Tough. If it makes you uncomfortable to hear those stories, imagine how uncomfortable it is to have lived that experience, to have, you know, done that act that violated that moral norm. You have an obligation to hear that story. You have an obligation to take some of the weight, take some of that burden and put it on your own shoulders. And I think that that's really, really important. So what can people do? Ask to hear those stories and provide those veterans with a safe, judgment-free place to share them. And help them know that you're there to carry that weight for them. That's what we owe these men and women.
The book is called Once a Warrior, and in it, Jake Wood shares some of the stories of his experiences 4 years in the Marine Corps with readers that led to the creation of Team Rubicon, the organization that he now leads as CEO and marking its 10th anniversary. Thanks for spending time with C-SPAN. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.